From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard, and joining me on the show this week are Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington, D.C., and Arshad Mohammed, U.S. foreign policy correspondent for Reuters News Agency. And here are the issues. In Houston, Texas, two rivals of Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump attacked him aggressively in a nationally televised debate on numerous grounds, including his hiring of immigrants rather than American citizens. The harsh criticism of Trump came days before 11 state contests on Tuesday, in which Trump is heavily favored to win most, if not all of them, and move closer to claiming the Republican nomination for president. Meanwhile, President Obama proposed to close the prison at Guantanamo and send the remaining prisoners to American jails and a few other sites. The White House also said it was considering a Republican governor, Brian Sandoval of Nevada, to succeed Antonin Scalia on the Supreme Court. Sandoval withdrew his name quickly, and Republicans insist they will block any nominee during Obama's final year in office. And Apple, the technology company, asked a federal court in California to drop its order, forcing the company to unlock the iPhone used by one of the gunmen in a terrorist attack in San Bernardino, California, in December. Well, you know, I thought of maybe we'd start with Gitmo or Apple or something, but the debate among the five Republican presidential candidates, Michael, was unlike one I've ever seen before. I mean, it was brutal, the attacks on Donald Trump, Donald Trump's unfriendly responses and so on. What'd you make of the whole thing?
Well, you know, Donald Trump, as he has for the entire election cycle, has placed his stamp on this presidential election. And never was that more true than last night. That was in his realm. It was, I mean, cue the analogies, mudslinging, cage match, wrestling, you know, cockfight. There are all kinds of things that this has been called. It lacked certainly the dignity and level of conversation that we'd expect.
Except for John Kasich.
Except for John Kasich. And you'd think somebody's going to make a bumper sticker that says Adults for Kasich at some point.
It occurred to me.
He was dignified and, getting back to Kasich. But but Donald Trump has defined this thing. He has now also been attacked for the first time by multiple candidates at the same time. And they called him out on his vulnerabilities. No one else has done that before effectively. I called him out on his hiring practices, on his income tax returns. He has clearly shown some vulnerabilities, and these guys now know that they have to attack him if they're going to get to the nomination. It all goes through Trump. They can't continue to finish second and third and call it a win. That's not going to work anymore. They have to find a way to win, and to win, to be number one, you got to beat number one.
Yeah, and that's the problem that both Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, the two Republican senators who are running and were the attackers, that's the problem they have. They have to win somewhere. Arshad?
Well, possibly the most interesting moment of the debate for me was the exchange between Rubio and Trump, where Rubio essentially was calling Trump out on the lack of specificity on his health care or health insurance plans. And Trump then essentially went into sort of a general, there'll be lots of competition, lots of plans, it'll be beautiful. And Rubio essentially did a Christie and attacked Trump for repeating himself. The reason it struck me as interesting is twofold. One, it is pushing on what some people regard as one of Trump's, you know, few vulnerabilities, that it's not clear what his actual policies are on a lot of things. And then secondly, it showed that Rubio, who had gotten such a battering from Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, was able to turn the tables or try to turn the tables on Trump. So he's trying to overcome what was one of his big weaknesses earlier this year.
You know, Michael, here's what occurred to me. My wife and I were watching the show, and, you know, we haven't been sitting around talking about John Kasich before, the governor of Ohio who's running and is trailing well behind not only Trump, but Rubio and Cruz as well. And yet, he was the one, he didn't indulge in the attacks, all the arguments and everything that involved those three and the attacks on Trump. And he captured for me what I thought presidential debates were supposed to be about, not trying to take people down and humiliate them and so on, but let's say, what you do as president.
You know, coming into this race, I think very few people outside of the Kasich campaign thought that among the governors who were running that he'd be the last governor standing.
Boy, but I agree.
Governors are of a type when they run. It's usually why they do so well. They are the CEOs of states. They're, by nature and by job definition, problem solvers. And that's what John Kasich does on the stage. He tends to want to solve problems, to come to policy solutions to these issues, rather than getting into mudslinging and character defamation and all these things that so characterize the campaigns with the other guys. It's very appealing to me, but an election cycle where we have people that are making their decision based on the hate of government and throw the bums out, an experienced politician is exactly what people aren't looking for,
right?
Especially the Trump people. They want anything but a guy like John Kasich, which is, I think, sad for the nation that we don't consider a man with his obvious credentials and demeanor.
Yeah, don't you think, though, he's at in a weak political position because he's basically going to sort of skip the 11 events on Super Tuesday, primaries and caucuses, and then emphasize Michigan on March 8th and then his home state of Ohio on March 15th. You know, even if he wins, he'll be so far behind.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, there would have to be a series of car crashes and at least one Trumpster fire, as I've heard it put before, for him to actually be in a position to win this thing. I think in some levels he's running for vice president right now. He's making himself a very, very attractive person to be on a ticket with anyone who would emerge as a victor.
Well, Ohio is an important state. No
Absolutely.
Question about that.
Absolutely.
Here's the question that that comes out of those debates. Trump has been attacked by the press, and there have been criticisms of him in the debates, the earlier ones, nothing like this last one. And it didn't seem to hurt Trump at all. It didn't seem to detract from his appeal to this large group of mainly non-college working-class Republicans and attracting Democrats as independents as well. I just don't know whether these harsher attacks that came from Cruz and Rubio are going to dent Trump at all.
I think you're right, Fred, that is one of the big questions. Does it stick or doesn't it stick? The other question is that as the field has narrowed and as, you know, my colleagues and I have spent a lot of time talking to Republicans, and there are a lot of establishment and other Republicans who are mortified at the thought of a Trump candidacy. So the next question for me is, well, when and to what extent can to the extent that they still exist, the establishment Republican Party try to bring Trump down? So one question, if I may, that I'd be interested in is when do you think somebody like Kasich may make the decision that it's time for him to get out of the race for the sake of the party more generally?
Yeah.
And if he does that, when does he do it and how does he do it? Similarly, is it conceivable that either Rubio or Cruz would make a decision to fold their hand as well?
Well, I can answer that, actually. I mean, if Cruz loses to Trump in Texas next Tuesday, I think he's gone. If Rubio loses to Trump on March 15th in Florida, Rubio's home state, he's gone. And in Ohio, the primary is the same day. If Kasich loses, he's gone too, and we know who the Republican presidential nominee will be. Yeah. We're going to have to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more Issues in the News.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Welcome back to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes with Arshad Mohammed and Michael Williams. And Arshad, the president wants to close down Guantanamo Bay Prison. He said he tried to do it. Remember the order, I think it was either his first day in office as president in 2009, it said it should be closed in 1 year. Well, he didn't make that deadline, and now he wants to close it and send the hard cases who can't be released, and I guess that I'm not sure the number, somewhere between 30 and 60 has been mentioned, to unnamed prisons in the United States. What are the prospects here for Guantanamo actually being closed on Obama's watch?
Well, as you say, he's wanted to close Guantanamo Bay not just for 7 years since he first took office, but for longer than that, because he made it one of his signature issues during the 2008 presidential campaign. So the chances really rest very largely on Congress, which, as you know, in 2010 passed a law barring the transfer of these detainees to the United States. Absent a change of heart in Congress, and it's worth noting that at the time Congress voted for that, if I'm not mistaken, the Democrats had a narrow lead in the Senate and controlled the House.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be very hard to see how this happens. I mean, the other route to closure might be finding other countries that would take some of these people. And there, too, although the Obama administration has had some success, I mean, they've gone from 242 detainees when he took office to 91 today. It's been enormously difficult to persuade other countries to take the detainees. And then there's also the issue of recidivism, how many of those who end up getting transferred end up back on the battlefield, as mm-hmm. it were. So this is, I think most people who look at this see this as a really hard row for, an uphill climb is probably an understatement here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, since Republicans don't want to close the prison and Democrats don't want the prisoners, I think, to come to prisons in the United States itself, Guantanamo being in Cuba, of course, I'm not sure what the way out is for the president. I think it would be hard for him to do this unilaterally with an executive order, don't you think, Michael?
I think it's virtually impossible for him to do that, you know, given the statutes that are in place. And I agree mm-hmm. with what Arshad said. He sort of delineated the issues that face him and sort of the problems that face the president in terms of getting this thing done. And it was January 22nd, 2009. Yeah. We said 1 year, this is going to be closed. With the political climate, Democrats, as you said, Fred, Democrats are against it. Republicans are against it. The public is actually against it. A majority of Americans do not want it open, for better or for worse. And it's another policy that sort of, to me, sort of encapsulates the Obama presidency. He comes up with ideas that are very cerebral, very reasonable. It's cheaper to bring the prisoners there. We've mm-hmm. done very well in prosecuting in our federal courts, in our military courts, the ones that are due process in that way, according to the crimes that they were accused of. We have sent successfully a number of detainees to other countries where they have been monitored. It makes sense in a lot of ways, but it's just not politically feasible. It just isn't going to happen, especially in the heat of this election year. I admire him for putting it forward. It is a reasonable position, but politically, I think it's just untenable.
Okay, let's turn to the Supreme Court. I'll start with you, Michael, on this one. The president wants to name a replacement for Nino Scalia, the very conservative Supreme Court justice who died a couple weeks ago. Republicans say, look, our tradition in recent years is that we don't let a president do that in his last year. Of course, Democrats are behind the president on replacing Scalia, and they're going to fight about this all year. And the president, you know, maybe it was, I forget who it was, some Democrat was saying, you know, this was a little too cute when he released the name of the Republican governor in Nevada as someone he might pick.
Well, again, let's take a moment, as always, to mark the career of Justice Scalia,
right.
A remarkable career and a remarkable man in so many ways, who made an impression on the court, both stylistically and in sustenance, and how the court operates to this day. President Obama is fully within his right to make a nominee, and I believe that the Constitution says that the Judiciary Committee should consider that nominee. And again, we're talking about traditions. Mostly it's about coincidence. You know, when have we ever had a chance for this to happen? It just mm-hmm. doesn't happen that often. Is he a lame duck president? I don't believe so. I think you're a lame duck after another president is elected, not when you're in the final year. He's a short-term president. He's not a lame duck president.
Yeah, certainly doesn't want to be a lame duck president and is, you know, with big issues that he's putting on the table, like Guantanamo and this one and so on. He's not a lame duck. I agree.
He's in mm-hmm. full flight, actually, yeah. maybe mm-hmm. some more than in some other years of his presidency. Mm-hmm. So what it really does, really, this confirms the complete and utter politicization of the Supreme Court, which mm-hmm. is very, very sad. Justice Scalia was confirmed 98-0.
Mm-hmm.
98-0.
Yeah.
What are the chances that any justice, one of Scalia's sons couldn't get approved?
Yeah.
Like that.
Right.
So the president wants mm-hmm. to fill the opening mm-hmm. on the court. The Republicans want to replace Scalia. And that's where we run into the fork in the road here.
Mm-hmm.
I have two thoughts about this, for what it's worth. One is I spent 7 years covering the White House, both President Clinton and George W. Bush, and finding out who the administration is considering nominating to the Supreme Court is one of the hardest things you're ever going to do in life, if you can do it. The fact, as you said, Fred, that Brian Sandoval, the governor, the Republican governor of Nevada's name came out, I think is not perhaps an innocent fact. And that brings me to my second point, which is you really have to look at this in a entirely through a political prism. And there are certainly a lot of people who regard the leaking of Sandoval's name as the president's way of showing how much political pain he can potentially inflict on the Republicans. Here's a guy, popular governor, telegenic, has served as a judge, and you guys won't even give him a hearing? There was a really interesting and pretty pointed comment by I think by Harry Reid, the Democratic leader in the Senate, basically saying that it's terrible to see what the Republicans are willing to do to one of their own. So in this next year, I think the way to look at this is entirely through the political boxing match that's going on.
Yeah, Democrats, the one thing that has hurt them in their argument is so many of them, Vice President Joe Biden and others have said in the past, you know, no, we can't have any nominees in this last year. And I think who used the said not, we don't want one in the last 18 months of a president and so on. And of course, Republicans are feasting on these old quotes and they've been widely distributed. Okay, time for another break. We'll be right back with more Issues in the News.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
Welcome back. I'm Fred Barnes with Michael Williams and Arshad Muhammad. Apple. We all probably have iPhones. I certainly do.
Exactly.
And we all do. We're three for three. Arshad, what about this the case? Apple says if we let this out, this information that's on this terrorist phone that we have, it will jeopardize everybody's phone, basically.
Well, a couple of thoughts here. One is that what is going on this week is that a judge has ordered Apple to essentially unlock the phone of one of the accused San Bernardino killers. Apple's argument is that if they do that, it jeopardizes everybody's privacy. It sets a precedent. The Justice Department and the FBI make the case that this is basically law enforcement and that the government has the right to ask for all kinds of other information with a court order and that Apple should therefore do it. They're using an 18th century law, the All Writs Act, to push this through. And what Apple is essentially doing is forcing a broader social conversation on privacy, civil liberties, and you know, the pursuit of justice. In some ways, it makes me think of something that McGeorge Bundy once said, that's a former national security advisor to John F. Kennedy, about nuclear weapons, where the nuclear scientists felt like they should have some kind of a say over what happened with nuclear power and nuclear weapons. And Bundy said, well, who elected them? You know, this is ultimately up to the national authorities of the country. And that brings me to Congress, which is, you know, the fundamental, the simplest way to ultimately resolve this tough debate is for Congress to write a law about it. Now, whether a polarized Congress is going to do that or not is completely another question. But ultimately, it's something this society has to make up its mind about. Do we want privacy or do we want sort of government to have pretty much untrammeled access to our phones?
Yeah, Michael?
I'd say this is sort of an outcrop of the revelations of Ed Snowden and all of the government surveillance that was going on. And as a response to that, Apple and other tech companies hardened their silos against government intrusion, against government observation. So we have this technical response. And even as we speak, they're continuing to upgrade software so that it'll be even harder for governments to get into these phones. And I think Arshad is exactly right. The clearest and obvious solution is legislation to this effect, to say that this technology is now covered under the same ways that other 18th and 19th century technologies are. The phone, even live conversation, are covered by laws that allow law enforcement to do their job to protect the people. The balance of privacy versus security versus liberty. This is, I mean, this is the balance, that the trifecta that we're reaching for here in this age of open terrorism.
Michael, maybe you'll remember. I don't remember who the Republican presidential candidate in this recent debate said. What should have happened is the president should have gotten together, gotten the Apple people together and the FBI together. Was that John Kasich again? I'm not surprised. And worked it out in private. I'm not sure you could really do that.
Yeah, I don't think that the president really has the gravitas or the trust of all parties sitting at the table. I mean, theoretically, you know, in a perfect world, yeah, somebody could sit down and sort of broker this agreement and have reasonable minds come to a reasonable solution. But they are so far apart, you know, on their issues right now, with Apple trying to protect its brand and then the FBI, in a way, trying to protect its brand in that we can get the information that we need to. They're so far apart. I'm not sure that it's reasonable to say that any one person can sit down and broker that.
Yeah, I'm a little dubious. It's a nice idea, but I'm afraid not very realistic. We have, starting here, the cessation of hostilities in Syria. Are they going to really cease, Arshad?
Nobody knows is the answer. The cessation of hostilities, which is a weaker term for people stopping shooting at each other than a ceasefire, let alone a peace treaty, is supposed to start this weekend. And it will be enormously interesting to see both if the parties themselves, the Syrian government and its backers, the Iranian and the Russian governments, stop firing, and whether the rebels also stop shooting. One of the big loopholes in this effort, though, is that groups that are deemed terrorist, including Nusra Front and the Islamic State, are excluded. And the challenge there is that it allows everybody to keep pounding other people as long as they claim that those people are Nusra or Islamic State. That means it's very, very, very hard to police a ceasefire. I think a lot of people will be surprised if it actually takes hold. And as I say, the fighting can continue under the pretext of going after those two and other groups.
Gee, well, I had very little optimism about it earlier, and now I have none. Michael?
I can put you in deficit for hope, because I think it's virtually impossible. Look, the in the Balkans during that period of time, when you had maybe a comparable situation with multiple parties, long-term hostilities, a ceasefire was brokered, and there were 50,000 white helmets, troops that were put down to try to police this thing. Whenever there's an effective ceasefire, whenever there's an effective cessation of hostilities, there's someone there to enforce it. Who's going to be there to enforce it? There are absolutely no boots on the ground. To hope for a ceasefire that's self-enforcing between parties with these types of hostilities and these types of complexities, I think, is fantasy.
Arshad, let me ask you about this. I mean, I think it's unrealistic now to think we could have a no-fly zone in an enclave where the Syrians' refugees would not be refugees. They wouldn't have to flee to Europe. They would be safe there. Might that have worked at one time?
So the fundamental thing about a no-fly zone, or let's say a safe zone, is that it requires, as Michael just suggested, for a ceasefire, it requires that the zone be safe, and that means that you have to be able to patrol the skies. That means that you have to be able to protect the people that are on the ground. And Secretary Kerry, in testimony this week, said, look, that the Pentagon estimates are that's going to take 15,000 to 30,000 troops. Where are those troops going to come from? It's clear they're not coming from the United States or Europe or the Arab world. So
what does that leave?
Scant oil, yeah.
So, well, I know we can't have one now, but people thought, well, maybe a few years ago.
They did, in fact, try one within a year and a half, I think, of the conflict starting, and it essentially folded. I mean, there were, I believe, some Arab troops that went in, and it just didn't work.
Okay, that's all the time we have today. Joining us were Michael Williams of CBS Radio and Arshad Mohammed, U.S. foreign policy correspondent for Reuters. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineers are Jonah Cummings and Linus Rimkus. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Thank you for listening.